Israeli Jew, an Israeli American Jew. They said a real estate developer, Sam Basile. They said 100 Jewish donors had given to make the movie. I mean, all of these are lies, and they're playing on anti-Semitic stereotypes of, you know, wealthy Jews and manipulative, and it's protocols of the Elders of Zion kind of stuff. These are the people who were cooperating with the Islamophobic networks of people like Pamela Geller and Daniel Pipes. So they put this trailer up on YouTube, and they dubbed it into Arabic to make sure that those radical groups in the Arab world would see it and would know about it. And then they worked their networks in Egypt to make sure to draw attention to it. This was all a conspiracy. This trouble that we've been having the last week was gotten up by Islamophobic networks in the United States quite deliberately, and I think probably in hopes of intervening in the presidential campaign, of turning Barack Obama into a Jimmy Carter, maybe of provoking embassy hostage-taking and so forth. And they have succeeded in making a lot of trouble. So the worst people in both societies have gotten up this trouble. But I want to leave you with something hopeful here, which is most Egyptians and Tunisians and the places where American embassies have been attacked in the past few days are now very much devoted to parliamentary democracy. And they're going to have further parliamentary elections. And they put the Muslim fundamentalist parties in power often because they thought the Muslim fundamentalist parties are not corrupt. They believe in law and order. It's like the religious right in the United States gets votes in certain parts of this country for some of the same reasons. But what the religious right in these countries has demonstrated in the last week is that they're not very good about keeping order, and they have extremists in their ranks. And I think that what may happen is that these events could push politics, both in the United States and in the Middle East, to the left. And we see in Egypt already in the presidential election in May, the first round of the presidential election, the Egyptian left reemerged. The labor unions of Alexandria flexed their muscles and gave their votes to Hamdine Sabahi, who is a leftist. And he got about a fifth of the votes in the first round of the presidential elections. And I think we're going to see more of that as the Egyptians go back to the ballot box. The labor left is going to reemerge. In Egypt, in Tunisia now, the left is forming a new big party coalition. So I think this was a fluke that the Muslim fundamentalist parties did so well in the aftermath of the Arab Spring, and it had to do with hopes for ends of corruption, making sure the old regime didn't come back, and law and order issues. But I think that people are beginning to have their eyes open, that there are extremist elements also on the religious right. And so I think we, very ironically also in this country, the way that Governor Romney mishandled the Libyan embassy incident and quite outrageously accused Barack Obama of sympathizing with the attackers has harmed his campaign. I think President Obama is handling these issues in a wise and restrained way. I think I have written that I think he managed to convince Mohamed Morsi, a leader of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, who's now president, to condemn what was done at the American embassy after Morsi dragged his feet. And so both in the Arab world and the United States, I think these moments of turmoil are also moments in which the pure is separated out from the dross, in which character is tested. And I think in both societies we can hope to move forward towards a brighter and more progressive future. Thank you very much.
We have taken a survey, and we find out that 10% of you haven't given any money yet, and so they're going to pass the buckets right now. I get to tell one joke. Carpenter dies and goes to heaven. He gets there and senses the carpenter. He wanted to meet St. Joseph, but there was a long line of people waiting to talk to St. Joseph. So he looked around and he saw Mary was sitting by herself over on a bench. So he went over and he said, "May I sit and talk with you?" And she said, "Sure." So they talked for a while, and then she said she had to go. And he said, "May I ask you one question before you leave?" She said, "Sure." And he said, "Well, on earth, the pictures of you, you always seem very sad. And I was wondering if things hadn't gone well for you." And she said, "Well, you make an interesting point, because we kind of hoped we were going to have a girl." Oh, sure. I don't take this anti-Irish stuff. Ruth, are you... Some of you have heard today that we don't need heroes, because if you have a movement, then you can make sure that the movement is responsible. I think of Eugene Debs, who said, "I would not lead you into the promised land if I could, because if I could lead you in, any damn fool could lead you out." Now, I think there's some truth to that, but I have a hero, and I'm just about to introduce him here. If Phil would come forward. Phil Donahue. All right. You're losing your hero status here. There he is. He's right behind me. Please welcome our hero, Phil.
I am sorry. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Well, thank you very much. I was busy congratulating Professor Cole, and I missed my cue. I'd rather be Phil Donahue late than the late Phil Donahue. I was hoping that I would be recognized. And sure enough, out in the parking lot, somebody said, "Hey, Merv." But it is a big deal to follow these fabulous voices of conscience. This is a lineup here. You may not know this, but Jim Hightower can get CNN on his hat. And if he turns, he gets Fox, so he tries not to. And I see we have a drone here. I mean, we are sending unmanned aerial vehicles 4,000 miles to another country far away, and a man sits in a cage with a joystick and looks at a TV monitor, camera in the nose of this thing, and says, "There they are." And we fire it, and we are killing children. And this is on Obama's watch. Maybe this is why we have flames blazing all over the world. Australia's in this now. Australia is threatening the American embassy in Sydney. And people ask, well, why don't they like us? And by the way, you can't ask that question, because if you do, you're blaming the victim. This is just one of the ways it's so difficult to protest a war. Norman Solomon, who will follow me in a moment, took me to school. He makes the point in a book titled, and his movie titled, War Made Easy, that if a president wants a war, he can have one. We have millions and millions of proud Americans, church-going proud Americans, who always vote, who believe that to criticize a president who's ramping up for a war is unpatriotic, undermines our president, is disrespectful to the troops. Well, I was going to say that, but some of the nuns who taught me may be in the audience. You can't blame the victim. You can't criticize a war. Dissenting is very, very difficult. It's much too difficult. But we have now reached a point, and by the way, because we found it so difficult to dissent, we allowed George Bush, with the politics of fear, 3 weeks before an election, to take this whole nation by the ear and lead it right into the sword. Over 4,000 Americans dead. We haven't counted yet the number of Iraqis who died. At least 4 million refugees, because Bush said, bring it on. The root of our foreign policy has been a rootin' tootin' shoot, don't mess with Texas foreign policy. And we have to stop it. And I believe we can. And by the way, if we're not going to use our right to dissent, then stop sending all these young men and women to fight and die in the sand in places far away if we're not going to use it. Stop wasting their blood. We get a Neo-Mussolini and he'll tell us what's good for us and he'll make decisions behind closed doors. You can have any kind of country you want. The politics of fear works. That's our problem. And so I kind of made it my, a member of a colleague of mine on my own show during my short unhappy life at MSNBC said, that's the trouble with you liberals. You don't like anything about America. So if you criticize America, it means you don't like anything about America. This is another way they shush us. We are told to shut up and sing. But let's understand this. We're popular now. Our view is held by most Americans. We have to know that there's nothing radical or minority about us. And by the way, if you put the Bill of Rights to this House, it would pass. We've had free speech has become like a quaint idea. We appear to have evolved into a nation, or should I say devolved, into a nation that operates under the rule of law unless we're scared. If we're scared, the president has to protect us. The president has to listen in our phone calls. He has to put in people in cages halfway around the world, no Red Cross, no phone calls, no nothing. We can pull fingernails out, turn guys upside down, pour water down their nose, because the president has to protect us. It's a lesson on how easy it is to lose the fabulous insight of the framers. We're the patriots. We believe in the Bill of Rights. We believe a person's home is his castle. We don't believe you should be sneaking in there without judicial authorization. How easy it is for us to turn our back on the thing we brag about all the time. Democracy, democracy. Juan Cole made the point. Hell, less than half of us vote. We've chipped away at the bedrock of this nation. I'm afraid our president has a tin ear regarding the Bill of Rights, civil liberties, because he too has to protect us and then bring along media. Tell me about media. Before Rupert Murdoch hits the floor in the morning on the occasion of his awakening, he's thinking how today he will bust a union. He has been the most successful union buster, purveyor of propaganda in the history of media. This is a chapter in, I think, American politics, and we should say world politics. And that's why we want to pay more attention to John Nichols and Robert McChesney. These people... These people are doing more to remind us of the influence of media. And now, what do we have? We have the shirts and the skins. Political commentary has become a contact sport. CNN has some rating problems now, real ratings problems. And I believe it's because they don't have enough people on CNN shouting at each other. You watch the evening news as I do, the evening cable news as I do. I mean, you'll see some of the most horrible rhetoric possible. People are saying hateful things about each other. People on one side are suggesting they know about the condition of the soul of another person on the other side. You will never hear anything remotely positive about, for example, President Obama on Fox. Never. And isn't it interesting? I was fired from MSNBC for opposing the war because I was a liberal. I was counted, by the way, as I had to have two conservatives on for every liberal. That was a mandate. I was considered two liberals. So, I mean, talk about power. And weren't the framers, consider the insight that the framers had. Don't ever unite politics and religion. What a fabulous idea. And this is almost 300 years ago. I don't mind a president who talks to God every day. I've been known to do that myself. I don't want a president who talks to God every day and God talks back. That's the reason. And as we look at the fires across the world, you can see it tonight on CNN. We see what theocracy can do, what dogma can do. You know, when I was a kid, I was a Catholic, and I was the best kind of Catholic. I was an Irish Catholic. Boy, you know, I had a pope who couldn't make a mistake. I had a day where they marched. I marched in the St. Patrick's Day parade. I felt sorry for people who weren't Irish Catholic. We had the best music. Tooraloo-ra-loo-ra. I mean, I thought, wow, am I lucky. I didn't care for Presbyterians, you know what I'm saying? And Episcopalians. This is the beginning of it. This is the beginning of it. I've got God and you don't. And if I have God and you don't, I can do all kinds of things to you. The Christian church has done more to promote homophobia than any other single institution in the history of the world. And I'm now, it took a long time, it was hard to stand up and to say something like that. You know, my mother was watching me from her apartment in Rocky River, Ohio. And I was featuring people on my program who were saying things like this. And the scales were falling off my eyes. I was beginning to see it, to understand it, to understand that if the church thinks homosexuals are sinners, then I can beat them up. Some insecure young man in a bar can drink a lot of beer and go beat up queers outside the gay bar. Homophobia is lethal, and it's being promoted by the people who claim to be closest to God. This has to stop. So, where does that leave us now? We have millions of Americans who have already crossed the line of cynicism. What does it matter what I do? You know, hey, wars happen. A kind of surrender to the inevitability of war. And if that continues, we're going to lose this wonderful, fabulous idea called the United States of America. A wonderful experiment. in Republican democratic democracy. Fabulous. And we're all grateful for having been born, me by accident of birth, into this fabulous idea. But it's not going to stay. It's not going to keep if we don't do something about it. So in response to those people who have said to me, that's the trouble with you liberals, you don't love anything about America, I want to offer you just a couple of reasons why I do. And I'll just be brief about this. One is Lawrence v. Texas. That's the Supreme Court decision that shot down anti-sodomy laws. We had cops in a small town in Texas who would wait outside for nightfall, and they knew they had two gay guys living in that house over there. And they wanted to get them some queers. And they were constitutionally permitted to do so. And they knocked that door down with a flash. So what's going on in here? The gay and lesbian lawyers who argued this case got shot down at every level. And they finally got to the Supremes. And they sat there hardly able to breathe. And out come the nine robes. And the justices took their places. And it was Anthony Kennedy, a Catholic, by the way, who read the decision for the majority. And when he came to this sentence, there are some places in a person's life the state may not enter. And when he said that, the gay and lesbian lawyers who had fought and fought and fought bowed their heads and softly wept. This is how noble we can be. This is just one reason why. Imagine this decision in the Islamic world. That's how secure we are. That's how aware we are of how we have offended so many people we have along. Nobody's going up to a gay person today and say, I bet you're glad that's over. Because it isn't. It's a dragon that continues to work its death and destruction in our society. But we are doing more, I think, than any other nation on earth to fight it and to stop it. Another one that always fascinated me was the Jehovah's Witness case. Jehovah's Witness kids did not salute the flag. This is 1940. People are at war. They're dying. Pacific, in the European theater. And the children stood up at Pledge Allegiance to the flag. Jehovah's Witness kids. You're in the third grade. There is no word to describe the loathing we felt for those kids. We threw stones at them. I remember walking past a Kingdom Hall in my own neighborhood. Remember, I'm the Catholic. I'm in the one true church. And I thought, boy, I bet, you know, what about those weirdos? I might have thrown a stone at these people. Somebody put rope around the necks of Jehovah's Witnesses. By the way, they wouldn't serve in the army. You can't. And they drove people crazy. You know, Jews go to temple. Catholics go to mass. Jehovah's Witnesses go door to door. And drive everybody crazy. And the Supremes in 1940 said, you have to salute. And the school that expelled you has a constitutional right to make you salute. William O. Douglas, salute, you little bastard, or whatever they said. I wasn't there. Felix Frankfurter, salute. I, salute. Imagine, some of the most liberal members of our court. Exactly 3 years to the month later, June 1943, the Supremes take it back. And William Gobitis, this is the case in West Virginia, is standing there. He held onto the pockets of his breeches to keep the teacher from pulling his arm up to salute. And this little kid, you don't know powerless until you saw this little kid. And this is what the Constitution is about. Protect the powerless. And we had a nation. We had a hostile population coming down on this little kid. who stood there with his hands on his pockets. And comes down, second decision, 1943, comes down from the mountain, Robert Jackson, and delivered one of the greatest lines in the history of Supreme Court writing, in my opinion. If there is any fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it is that no official, high or petty, can prescribe what shall be orthodox in religion, nationalism, politics, or any other matter of opinion. You cannot force an American to believe anything. You can't force an American to believe in the Constitution, which gives you the right. How mature we are, how secure we are to say that. You want to worship a pet rock, that's your business. And by the way, we don't trip over our robes, God blessing this, that, my dog and my cat. I think that's false piety, and I think it's for short-term political gain. And I don't think we should necessarily applaud it, ever. Our faith, if we have one, comes from in here. One more story. Not long ago, my wife Marlo Thomas wrote a book titled, I'll tell her you welcomed her. I'm sorry she's not here. She's in Memphis, which is the location of the hospital that her father, Danny Thomas, founded, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. Marlo is one of the chief fundraisers. She calls fundraising the world's second oldest profession. And she says it's just as tiring. Now, the book was titled The Right Words at the Right Time. And it included essays. You could write your own essay or someone would write it for you and then you got final cut. Nobody published anything that you didn't agree with. One was written by an Iraq veteran, a soldier, an active duty soldier, who was standing in line at McDonald's. And he was really in a depression. He had just come back from active duty and he's probably going to be reassigned. And he's thinking, nobody knows what I'm going through. Nobody knows the danger of the men and women that I fought with. Nobody knows the pain of seeing guys die in front of you. And he felt awful. He really was depressed. He understood suicide and why there were so many. And he finally got up to the counter. The older I get, the easier I cry. He ordered his Big Mac and his fries. Little girl, looked like she was 12. Got the fry. He had the $10 bill in his hand. And she gave him the bag. And she reached out and shook his hand and said, "Thank you for your service." And he felt his $10 bill come back into his own palm. This is how noble we can be. This little girl gave him his money back. "Thank you for your service." We are noble people. And we are in danger of losing this feeling about ourselves. And if we do, we're finished, really. And I've seen so many people run out and wave their arms for a weekend and then just sputter out. They are the feather and the problem is the Rock of Gibraltar. And they quit. They take guitar lessons, maybe yoga, or they live under a car top in northern New Mexico. I mean, a lot of people I saw in the Vietnam, that all the tie-dye t-shirts and all the kids were out there, kids getting beat up by the cops, brave, brave kids, just have their energy just drain out of them. That's what we can't let happen. We have to keep on keeping on. We have to remember the little girl and William Gobitis who had the courage Robert Jackson essentially said to those little kids, you obey your parents. What's American to us? It shouldn't have taken the High Court to make this case, but they did. The system worked. The framers were right. The framers were right. You worship who you want to worship. And don't do an 8-year-old Phil Donahue who wants to throw stones at Jehovah's Witnesses because they were weird. I had no idea what was going on in that building. But I knew they were weird. So let's understand how we are all influenced. I feel I'm very good at telling people what they already know. And I know that you know these things. But let's understand that we have to prevent ourselves from staring at our shoes, getting depressed, and decide we're going to do nothing. We have a right to be happy. The young men and women who died to protect this Constitution and this nation, the memory of those people now dead is not honored if we fold up, if we collapse. So our job is to not stare at our shoes. Once again, understand that we have millions of Americans today who agree with us. Our problem is to get them to stand up and say so. That's the biggest challenge we have, climbing the wall of apathy so that we can get on the road to peace. I believe it can happen. I believe it can happen. Here we are. It's as great to be surrounded by people who agree with me. I feel like I'm in Disney World. This is a wonderful, wonderful opportunity. This grand assembly of people of conscience is the direct result of an attorney I know personally by the name of Ed Garvey, who reminds me of all my younger relatives, is the son my mother wanted to have, and who is responsible for me having the joy of this experience twice now. And the more I'm here, the more I am impressed. So, let's remember all those young men and women who came home in a pine box with a flag, the ones that the press wasn't allowed to take pictures of in the land of free speech, free press. Let's, in their memory, enjoy the life that somehow, for whatever fateful reason, we continue to enjoy. Let's sing and dance. Let's show the world that those who protest are as American as they are, and those who protest are not going to sink into depression and sour faces, and we're not going to stare at our shoes. We're going to go to Badger games, Packer games. We're going to have tailgate parties, and we're going to think about all those people who will never get that opportunity again. And we're going to be grateful for this. And we're going to work. We're going to reach out. We're going to see ourselves in another person's face. And we are going to know that we're not alone. And we're going to have larger and larger people marching with us, singing with us, walking in the park and holding hands with somebody they love, because those other young men and women will never have that opportunity. And walking in the park is something that people in this unusually beautiful city have more than one opportunity to do. So I'm looking for you in the park. And I'm hoping that someday we may, who knows, I may be able to dance with some of the women. Not close, of course. But this is the kind of personality that we want our political movement to include. We want to be grateful, we want to laugh, and we will dedicate ourselves to never forgetting what these young men and women did for us. And we're going to make sure that more and more people who agree with us get out there and say so. I'm honored to be in your company, and I thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. I want to tell you, I met Norman Solomon a couple years ago after reading his book titled War Made Easy. He's the one that made me smart on this. This is a scholar. This is a man with unusual insight. He has a documentary that dovetailed with mine that shows you how easy it is to get. It's Norman who said in his book, if a president wants a war, he can have one. And now it's my pleasure. I want to remind you, my documentary is titled Body of War. His documentary is titled War Made Easy. And you will be instructed by his documentary, I promise you. And it's my honor to present Norman Solomon.
Someone who, during decades on national television, refused to cross a Union picket line ever, Phil Donahue. Someone, the most influential male feminist in the history of American television, Phil Donahue. And someone who, when the dogs of war were screaming for blood, when we heard about the smoking guns that weren't supposed to turn into mushroom clouds, when the lies were presented and gift-wrapped as truth to the American people, when dozens and dozens and dozens of national TV network hosts ran for cover and saluted the military invasion to come, there was one national network TV host who said, we will speak about alternatives to war. We will speak about those alternatives now. Phil Donahue. Now, here we are, just about a decade after that time. And it's real important, as always, for us to try to grasp the historical moment as we now breathe. We live at a time when one major political party has given faith a bad name. And when the other major political party has given hope a bad name. And those realities should not change the imperative, the necessity that we live with faith and hope, faith, a secular faith, in the power, potential, and necessity of democracy. It's our only hope, right? And that answers the other part of it, that our hope is predicated on the understanding hitched to the locomotive of action that you have demonstrated to the world in Wisconsin in the last years, and that we have to learn how to show more and more around this country at the grassroots that only democracy can save us and only we can make democracy happen. Now, I believe that it's essential at all times for us to strive for a combination that I've come to think as feet on the ground, eyes on the stars of our ideals. We know what happens with just one and not the other. When you go to the major legislatures in the states of this country and you go to Washington, D.C., to the Congress, you can see what happens when the leaden feet are on the air and the ideals have been winnowed down and watered down and rationalized away. You get pretty much what we've gotten, which is totally unacceptable. And we know what happens when we don't got feet on the ground and we got those eyes on the stars of our ideals. We get some good books, we get some good films, we get some good speeches, and we don't get the job done. We got to get the job done because that's what making democracy work is all about. Now, one of my heroes as a Californian is Upton Sinclair. Upton Sinclair, who wrote many books, who raised hell with his words, and then in 1934, he ran for governor of the state of California on a platform, Epic, End Poverty in California. Can you imagine in 2012 somebody running End Poverty in the United States? What a concept that we need. And something that Upton Sinclair said stays with me. He said, "I've written enough words. The world needs a deed." The words are necessary, I'd add, but insufficient. And as we look at deeds, as we try to grasp where we are at this historical moment, let's be clear. As progressives, we are committed to fighting for social justice, whether the person in the Oval Office is a Republican or a Democrat. We progressives believe in habeas corpus, whether the person in the Oval Office is a Republican or a Democrat. We don't believe in summary execution, no matter what the party is of the president. And we don't believe in busting unions or perpetual war either, no matter what the party of the president. And on and on and on. You know, as I was involved in my own political campaign in California, I was running with a bunch of other Democrats, and we talk about No Child Left Behind, boo. And then we talked about Race to the Top. I was the only one saying it's unacceptable. It doesn't matter what wrapping you put around the poison pill. It's still a poison pill. Now, I got to admit, I came here asking, well, I don't think favors is quite the right word. Because you're doing yourself a big favor, too, if you fulfill these requests. But on behalf of the other 49 states and the District of Columbia, I do have some requests to the good people of the state of Wisconsin. One is, would you please do everything you can to send to the United States Senate Tammy Baldwin? And also, would you do everything you can to make sure that the electoral votes of this state do not go to create a Vice President Ryan and a President Romney? And that means doing everything you can to get as many votes in this state for Barack Obama. Now, some people call it walking and chewing gum at the same time. And some people call it dialectics. And some people call it all sorts of other things of all sorts of lengths of syllables. But whatever we can grasp, we can understand, and we can act upon simultaneous realities that seem to be and perhaps are in conflict. We understand that in the real world, contradictions exist. And I'd like to summarize one that I know I wrestle with all the time, and good chance you do too. President Obama is no progressive. There's no point in pretending he is. He has not only betrayed progressives, but he has betrayed the Bill of Rights, he has betrayed poor people, he has betrayed children, he has betrayed the elderly, and I'm still just talking about the United States of America, let alone around the world. He has betrayed our progressive values. At the same time, there are a dozen states in this country that are called swing states, and we're in one of them. And Governor Romney and Congressman Ryan are hoping. They're hoping that you and people who listen to you and people you might reach out to, Romney and Ryan are hoping that you will help them get the electoral votes in this state. And I am asking you, if you have any hesitation, I am asking you to think more about this and to make sure that when election night comes and as the votes are tallied, when Romney and Ryan look at the big map and they look at the state of Wisconsin, that you have disappointed them. Now we, to sort of sum up my thoughts here for now, I feel that as progressives we have, you might say, two overarching responsibilities. One is historic. I mean, I don't know what they called people who were out saying, you know, let my people go, very millennia ago, whether they were called commies or anarchists or, you know, whatever. Syndicalists, radical unionists. But for millennia, the fight against oppression, against racism, xenophobia, misogyny, nativism, that fight has gone on century after century and millennia after millennia, and it continues today. And no matter what you call us, progressives or whatever, we have a responsibility to engage in that fight 24/7, 365. And those beachheads that are still being landed on are being landed on by the Republican Party. And they've got to be defeated. And there's no time like the present. There's no time like this year. And the other responsibility is to move progressive policies and ideals into implementation and into action. And the failures of the current administration in the White House, we say no, it is totally unacceptable to abdicate those progressive responsibilities. And we're going to fight like hell for those responsibilities to be implemented. So I'd like to close on a couple notes. One is that organizing is always key to any success of any movements. And I'd like to share with you, and I hope if you've got something to write with, I was going to say a pen, but you know it sounds sort of old-fashioned. If you got something to note, I'd like to give you the name of an organization that now has 175,000 progressives online, opted in, getting messages along the lines of the politics, I've described. It's called rootsaction.org. And if you go to that site, we can be wired together. We put out several email alerts a week, or at least a couple of them. Founded by Jeff Cohen, the founder of the Media Watch Group FAIR, and myself. You may know David Swanson. He works on this every day as well. Many, many others. So I want to ask you, so that we can be connected together as an action arm, a progressive action arm around the country, go on. It'll take about 30 to 45 seconds. Add your email address. We'll be in touch. Again, rootsaction.org. R-O-O-T-S. Action.org. As I say goodbye, and I've been so happy after a decade to finally get myself to Fighting Bob Fast, and thanks for that invitation to be here. I was thinking yesterday about where I was 10 years ago, and I don't know why, but the thought the question came into my head. And I realized very quickly that September 13th, 14th, and 15th of the year 2012 is exactly 10 years after, in the year 2002, I was in Baghdad. And you may remember that the early fall of 2002 was a time when the war drums were beating louder and louder. President Bush did not want UN weapons inspectors back into Iraq. And so I went with one of the great progressives from the upper Midwest, Jim Abaresk, former Senator Jim Abaresk, as well as a sitting member of Congress at that point and still is, Nick Rahal, and Jim Jennings from Conscience International. And we went, and long story short, and we were in the streets and in the offices and suites of Baghdad exactly at this moment, exactly 10 years ago, we met officials of the Iraqi government as an exercise of citizen diplomacy to try to find an alternative to what we feared and what did become the invasion and occupation of Iraq. And as I went through the streets of Baghdad on that day, on those mornings and afternoons and evenings, I saw people of all ages. And as I mentioned last night at the Goodman Community Center, I looked in the eyes of children and elderly, and I thought, will my country bomb you? We know the answer to that question now in terms of Baghdad. But the question still lingers in Iran, and in fact, in countries that we may not even think of day after day or even year after year. But we live in a warfare state, and the only way to end the warfare state is democracy, and we're the people to make it happen. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, our next speaker led a really dynamic session on the war on women earlier today, and it's my great pleasure to introduce her again. She got her start in politics in the early 1990s when David Duke ran for the governor of Louisiana. Terry O'Neill went door to door to get out the vote against David Duke. She taught feminist legal theory, international women's rights law, corporate law, and legal ethics at Tulane and the University of California, and has been part of the organization, the National Organization for Women, and its leadership for many, many years. But she made it her full-time job in 2009. And as part of what she did when she took over the National Organization for Women and became part of its leadership was to re-energize that organization. According to Washington Post, with her strategy of tapping into the energy and outrage of women all over the country, over all the ground that we lost during the Bush administration, she really created a new burst of activism within this existing organization. And I think this is a model for all of us in the progressive movement. We have these great organizations. Some of them have gone to sleep a little bit, but there is this huge potential there, this huge grassroots energy, and nowhere is that more evident than in the war on women. So without further ado, I give you Terry O'Neill.
Thank you so much, Ruth. Thank you, Ed Garvey, for inviting me to be here. I am thrilled to be talking to you all. I do want to talk about the war on women, and I think it's important for people to understand, first and foremost, the war on women really has at least three fronts. It is not merely a war on women's reproductive rights, although it is that. It is also a war on women's economic security. It is also a war on women's ability to be protected from physical violence. Make no mistake, the 2010 elections were even more disastrous for women than we thought they were when they happened 2 years ago. Right. After Citizens United, the first federal election to follow Citizens United was 2010. And what happened? Tea Party extremists flooded into the United States Congress and flooded into states like Wisconsin and Michigan and Indiana and Florida and Pennsylvania. You know, just coincidentally, those are swing states for 2012. The Tea Party extremists, funded by the likes of David Koch and pushed by the likes of Dick Armey and Karl Rove, is a radical right-wing initiative. And who did they go after first? They went after the women. The entire 112th Congress, for 2 years of the 112th Congress, this is the kind of thing that we have seen. Let me talk first about women's economic security. The Romney-Ryan budget. Right? What does the Romney-Ryan budget do? This is the budget plan created by Paul Ryan. I forgive you. But you know, he's from here. I'd really rather he just come back here and stay. Oh no, you don't want him either, right? What the Romney-Ryan budget would do first, it converts Medicare to a private voucher system that will end up costing seniors over $6,000 per year more for health care than what they currently pay. This has a very disproportionate impact on women. Women utilize Medicare more often than men. Women have more chronic conditions than men, especially after the age of 65. And women have less money in their pockets at the end of their working life after a lifetime of unequal pay. Where are they going to get that $6,000? Paul Ryan says that he's going to save Medicare by turning it into a private voucher system. He also says that we shouldn't worry about it because he won't privatize Medicare until 2023. So current seniors would continue to have whatever plan they have. But what he doesn't tell you is that he's got a plan to repeal the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, so that seniors would immediately see their health care costs going back up after we appeal Obamacare. Right? That's why we call him Lion Paul Ryan. Right? The Romney-Ryan budget would also convert Medicaid to a state block grant program and drastically reduce the amount of federal money going into the state. So it doesn't really matter how sick you get. If you're a low-income person and you're eligible for Medicaid, it doesn't really matter how sick you get. The federal government sends so many dollars to each state, period, the end. After that, you're on your own. The Romney-Ryan budget also takes Social Security and puts it on a fast track for future benefit cuts, changes the way we do budgets every year so that Social Security could be cut easily, quickly, and Congress wouldn't be able to stop it. And then the Romney-Ryan budget takes an entire range of social programs. These are things that are socially productive for this country. It's Head Start. It's family planning clinics. It's Pell Grants that allow kids to go to school and afford the tuition. It's after-school programs so that moms and dads who are working can know their kids will be safe after 2:30 when school lets out. All of these things would be defunded significantly under the Romney-Ryan budget. And do we squeeze down the federal budget deficit by making all these cuts? No. No. The entire savings from all of these cuts, the Medicare, the Medicaid, the Social Security, and all of the social programs, all of that savings goes for increased spending on the military and enhanced tax breaks for corporations and billionaires. Right. And women bear the brunt of all of this. Those social programs that are socially productive, they not only disproportionately serve women, they are also disproportionately employing women. Just to take Medicaid as an example, half of Medicaid dollars go to support nursing homes in this country. Half of Medicaid dollars support nursing homes in this country. And thousands will be shut down if the Ryan Romney plan to gut Medicaid were to pass. Thousands. All right? Who lives in nursing homes? 70% of the residents of nursing homes are women. And equally importantly, the vast majority of the workers in nursing homes are women. So grandma gets kicked out, and she's going to come, she has to go somewhere. Where is she going to go? And the women who are working have lost those jobs, and where are they going to go? It's absolutely astonishing that Paul Ryan actually has been called a serious person with serious ideas about fixing our economy. Not. The role in women has also taken aim at women's ability to be protected against violence in their own homes. The Violence Against Women Act was passed in the mid-1990s. It was a tough uphill battle to get the Violence Against Women Act passed, but it did pass. And ever since the 1990s, every time it comes up for reauthorization, it has been passed with flying colors, almost unanimously, in a very bipartisan way, until the 112th Congress. The Violence Against Women Act is really very simple. It provides services to victims and survivors of domestic violence, dating violence, sexual assault, and stalking. It provides services to survivors and holds perpetrators accountable. Pretty simple. This year, the Senate passed an inclusive version of reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. Inclusive because it pays attention to underserved populations, Native American women, who are very often assaulted by non-Native men on tribal lands, and the tribal authorities don't have jurisdiction to prosecute non-Native individuals living on those tribal lands or committing crimes of violence on those lands. So the Senate bill addresses that. The Senate bill addresses the needs of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender victims who report at a rate of 80% that they cannot access services for domestic violence. The Senate version also provides measures for immigrant women who may find themselves being battered by their sponsor and need to be able to get off the track where their sponsor is controlling their immigration papers and get onto a track where they control their own immigration papers. The Senate bill deals with that. Also provides better services for women on college campuses who are sexually assaulted. Over in the House, Speaker John Boehner decided that he was having none of all of this inclusive stuff. And he engineered passage of a bill that is so bad that he could only force it through on a basically party line vote. 23 brave Republicans voted against it because it doesn't contain any of these protections for underserved populations. And in fact, with respect to immigrant women, it actually put in provisions that may put them more at risk. It provided for early notice to sponsors of immigrant women who are battering the women they're sponsoring. We are now stuck in a procedural loop where John Boehner is refusing to take up the bipartisan inclusive Senate version of the Violence Against Women Act simply because he doesn't want to give the Democrats a win on inclusive policies. Right. Okay, and finally we get to women's reproductive health care needs. The very first thing that the 112th Congress did in the House of Representatives was go after Planned Parenthood. Right. Planned Parenthood, which provides contraceptives, mammograms, cervical cancer screenings. Planned Parenthood, who for some low-income women is the only doctor they see once a year to get their annual checkups. Planned Parenthood, which provides safe and medically appropriate abortions for women when they come in exercising their constitutional right to it. Planned Parenthood, this is the target of the brave Tea Partiers who come to Congress to fix the economy. Okay. H.R. 1 provided defunding for all family planning clinics. And let's just pause for a moment. Family planning, contraception. This H.R. 1 was a continuing resolution to fund the entire government. It contained a provision to defund Title X family planning clinics. Think back to the days when women did not have access to reliable contraception. And they had 10 or 15 or 20 pregnancies and childbirths in their lifetime. And women died young. And they lived sick, not like today, because we have access to contraception. But oh no, the 112th Congress, the radical fringe that now controls the Republican Party in the House of Representatives wants to go after family planning. They also voted on a bill to shut down both private and public insurance for abortion care. And you know, one in three women will have an abortion by the age of 45. One in three by the age of 45. It's a common and necessary aspect of women's reproductive health care. There was another bill put into the 112th Congress that would give a conscience clause to publicly funded hospitals that would allow a hospital to stand by and allow a pregnant woman to die rather than perform a life-saving abortion. This is in the United States Congress. This is really what we're up to. Meanwhile, at the state level, the Tea Party extremists pushing for anti-reproductive rights bills passed nearly 100 laws, passed and signed into law, nearly 100 of them in 2011 alone, shattering the prior record of 2005 when only something like 32 or 35 anti-abortion measures were passed. These include ultrasound, mandatory ultrasounds that a woman must undergo before she can have an abortion, for no medical reason whatsoever, not medically indicated, and the only purpose of that exercise is to humiliate and embarrass her. But there's hope. There is hope. First, remember Susan G. Komen for The Cure? And Susan G. Komen announced that it was going to defund Planned Parenthood. We don't want Planned Parenthood providing mammograms anymore for Susan G. Komen Race for the Cure. The reaction by women through Facebook and Twitter and in other methods was so huge, Susan G. Komen's funding went down by 30% this year. And if they don't start depoliticizing breast cancer, they will not exist in 5 years. Remember Rush Limbaugh? You know, his national advertisers don't remember him either. They're all gone. When Governor Bob McDonnell was presiding over a Virginia legislature considering mandatory ultrasound for women seeking abortions, 1,500 people, men and women, stood in a gauntlet, in a silent vigil, a huge long line leading to the House of Delegates in Richmond, Virginia, that all of the delegates had to walk past as they filed into the building to cast their vote on that ultrasound bill. 1,500 people just showed up in Richmond to protest this outrage. And finally, women legislators are stepping up and proposing important legislation. As Senator Nina Turner of Ohio has said, we want to show the men the love. And therefore, a number of women have proposed laws that before a man can access Viagra or other erectile dysfunction medication, he must undergo a digital rectal exam. A heart stress test. He must produce an affidavit from his sexual partner attesting to the fact that, yes, he does need this medication. In one state, he must view a film that graphically describes what could go wrong if he uses this medication. And in another state, he must undergo counseling about the advantages of a celibate lifestyle. And who says feminists don't have a sense of humor? So what can we do? Well, we take our sense of humor, we take our passion, we take our outrage at this war on women, and we take it door to door. We elect officials who will be champions for women's rights. We send Tammy Baldwin to the United States Senate. And we hold the elected officials accountable after they're elected. We re-elect Barack Obama and Joe Biden, and we hold them accountable after they're re-elected. And we talk to our neighbors, we talk to our friends, we talk to our families, we send letters to the editor, we write op-eds for our local newspapers. We get the word out about, A, what's at stake for women in these elections. We will not let the Tea Party, despite all their billions, take over our lives. And B, we need to look to the long run. After this election, we will be holding the electeds accountable, whoever they are. We will be rising up continually because we have the information, we have the people on our side, and that's how we're going to win. Thank you so much.
How do you look this up?
There we go. I'm back. Matt Rothschild back at the podium for a second to simply introduce Dr. Jill Stein, who's running for President of the United States on the Green Party ticket. Jill Stein actually grew up in my hometown of Highland Park, Illinois, and I can tell you she's no slouch. She graduated from Harvard Medical School and practiced internal medicine in Massachusetts for many years, focusing on the environmental threats to children's health and the health of the elderly. She's been a Green Party activist for at least 10 years now. Actually, she ran against Mitt Romney once before in the governor's race back in 2002 in Massachusetts. So she knows all about Mitt Romney. She also knows all about corporate Democrats, too. You know, Joe Biden was in the state last week, and Obama's coming next week or the week after that. It's nice to know that they finally can find Wisconsin on the map. Now, I'm not going to tell you how to vote on November 6th, and I hate when people tell me how to vote on November 6th. But I do want to say two things. One, we shouldn't sneer at people or scold people who want to register their protest by voting for Jill Stein and the Green Party. We shouldn't do so because they're trying to build a progressive alternative to the duopoly of the two corporate parties, and we desperately need an alternative to that duopoly. And secondly, we should never sneer at progressives or scold progressives who are protesting. We shouldn't repress the impulse to protest against injustice because that's the most important impulse in our bodies. I give you Jill Stein.
Thank you all so much. Thank you, Wisconsin. Thank you, Fighting Bob, for bringing us to a really historic moment that we are in right now. Because as you know, there is a struggle going on for the soul of America, and that struggle started right here in Wisconsin. And the question is, which Wisconsin is going to win? Will it be the Wisconsin of Paul Ryan? the big spender turned deficit hawk after voting for 65 different bills that added $7 trillion to the national deficit? Or will it be another campaign that borrowed the Wisconsin motto, forward, but whose policies are business as usual that's taking us backward, and whose candidates somehow couldn't find the time, or I should say wouldn't find the time, to come help Wisconsin in its hour of greatest need? Or will it be the Wisconsin of Fighting Bob and Belle La Follette and their brand of independent, progressive politics that lives on today, that all of us here represent, and that my campaign is proud to carry into the 2012 presidential election? And that's why my campaign is headquartered here in Madison, Wisconsin. We don't have to come here and visit because we live here. And we live here because the purpose of our campaign is to bring that spirit of the Wisconsin uprising to the nation and make it go national, because that is what this nation needs now. Having crisscrossed this country for 10 months, I can definitely report that the La Follette spirit is on the loose and that the Wisconsin uprising lives on. The recall failed, it's true, but that recall was not the uprising. There was no way to pack the uprising into an establishment campaign that virtually dropped collective bargaining and bragged that it was not labor's choice. In fact, the spirit of that uprising is still rising all around us, in the Chicago's teacher union strike, in the Occupy protests that still go on, in the student rallies against tuition hikes, in eviction blockades, in Keystone Pipeline mass arrests, and in yesterday's decision by the Dane County Circuit Judge that the Walker Law violates state and U.S. Constitution and is null and void. And that's why this is an historic moment, because democracy and justice are breaking out all around us. And as they do, people are breaking away from the establishment politics that got us here in record numbers. Which means we can make this election a powerful tipping point to take back the promise of democracy and the peaceful, just, green future we deserve, and we deserve it now. We need that tipping point because we are at the breaking point for people, the planet, the economy, and our democracy. And we've come to this breaking point thanks to both establishment parties. They have delivered crisis after crisis. And on most key issues, in fact, the Obama White House has embraced the destructive policies of George Bush and even gone far beyond. If I can remind you, because you will be asked by your friends and your colleagues and your neighbors and your families, why you are standing up in this election. And the reality is that, yes, Obama has gone much further than George Bush could go, because under Democrats, unfortunately, the opposition goes to sleep. So under Barack Obama, we've gotten much bigger, massive bailouts for Wall Street, $700 billion under George Bush, but $4.5 trillion under Barack Obama, and that's just money dispersed. Add to that another $16 trillion in free loans. More of these corporate free trade agreements that offshore our jobs and undermine wages here at home. And in fact, Barack Obama advanced 3 new free trade agreements. Bill Clinton brought us NAFTA. George Bush continued to enact NAFTA, but it took a Democrat to actually expand the free trade agreements. And now we hear that he's negotiating a secret Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is basically NAFTA on steroids. Exactly. We're hearing again the threats to Medicare and Social Security, and remember where they started a year ago. I remember because that's the reason I got into this race. To me, it was unconscionable to let both Democrats and Republicans lead the charge to dismantle Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid. And I felt that, you know, for me, it would just be unconscionable to sit on the sidelines and let this go unchallenged. I don't know if you heard Bill Clinton defend the Democratic policy on Medicare at the DNC. I was really shocked. What he said was, because both the Democrats and Republicans are looking to cut Medicare by $700 billion over the next decade. They'll do it in different ways, but they have the same target. And what he said to Paul Ryan to try to rebut him, his pointing out that the Democrats were doing the same thing, Bill Clinton said, well, who are you, you know, who are you to accuse us of cutting Medicare because you're doing the same thing? That's not enough. We need to be standing up and expanding Medicare, in fact, so that we have Medicare for everyone. And on the foreclosure crisis, on the skyrocketing student debt, on the attacks on our imperiled civil liberties, Barack Obama actually embraced the attacks of George Bush and codified the violations of George Bush and went far beyond him to actually write into law the criminalization of protest, indefinite detentions, and these incredible attacks and assassinations on anyone at any time, anywhere, without having to so much as justify it to a court of law or accuse people of a crime. You know, it's staggering, the attack on immigrant rights, whereby this president deported more people in the first 3 years of his administration than George Bush had deported in 8 years. This is not okay. The attacks on medical marijuana and the plundering of our environment and the wrecking of the climate, the undermining of the climate accords at Durban and suggesting that, oh, we can wait until 2020, when in fact the science has made clear we cannot wait till 2020, and the science has proven to be far too optimistic. We can't wait till 2020. We can't wait till 2016. We need to stand up now. Not only to stop the Keystone Pipeline, we need to stop fracking. We need to stop the opening up of our Arctic and our national parks and our offshore oil. We need to say no to a whole new generation of nuclear power plants that this president has undertaken, in the wake of the ongoing Fukushima disaster, no less. So have we had enough? So when you hear the different narratives between the national Democratic and Republican operatives, remember, that's the talk, but it's the walk that counts. And there's now 4 years of walk for a Democratic White House, 2 of them under a Democratic Congress, and it's walking us backwards. It's accelerating us backwards in the wrong direction. And now, as the super rich continue to get richer, they're not offering anything new. if you've paid attention here, they're just saying be patient. It takes a long time. Well, it doesn't take a long time. When you want to do the right thing, we can start fixing this right now. So that's why people like you and I are standing up in a way that the world hasn't seen in a generation, in many generations, actually. We're a movement that's alive and well across America, and we are here to stay. We deserve a voice in this election and a choice at the polls, because voting for either Wall Street candidate, either Mitt Romney or Barack Obama, gives them a mandate for 4 more years of corporate rule. Even if in your mind it's a reluctant vote, in their mind it's validation for 4 more years of the same. Every vote that we receive is a vote for democracy, for the 99%, and for the planet. To achieve that future as president, I will work to deliver a Green New Deal for America, a package of emergency reforms that puts 25 million people back to work, that jumpstarts the green economy, and that economy can begin to put a halt to climate change and make wars for oil obsolete. It reforms not only our economy, but our financial system and our democracy as well. And it's not just an academic idea. It's based on a program that actually worked. It's tried and true. The New Deal that got us out of the Great Depression in the 1930s. The economic reforms of the New Deal, the Green New Deal, will create living wage, community-based jobs. And communities get to decide what kind of jobs they need to become sustainable, not only ecologically, but also socially and economically. And for starters, that means jobs in the green areas of the economy, in clean manufacturing, local organic agriculture, public transportation, including active transportation, and clean renewable energy. And it also jumpstarts the jobs we need to meet our needs socially, for teachers, for nurses, for childcare, after school, home care, senior care, violence and drug abuse prevention, rehabilitation, and affordable housing construction. The New Deal will also create an immediate moratorium on home foreclosures and evictions. We could have done this 4 years ago. The president actually was given $300 billion by Congress in order to buy up the foreclosures of threatened homes and to negotiate with homeowners, and he did not do it, saying that it was moral hazard. Well, the real moral hazard is in the Wall Street crooks who got us into this mess to start with. They need to be brought to justice, which this president has refused to do. It's time to hold the bankers accountable and the war criminals accountable, for that matter, not the homeowners. We need to bail out the homeowners. The Green New Deal guarantees health care for all, for everyone as a human right under Medicare for all. It provides not only quality, comprehensive health care for everyone, but it restores your choice of the healthcare provider and the healthcare treatments that you want, puts you back in control of your own healthcare decisions instead of having a profiteering insurance executive make those decisions for you. And a well-kept secret, it saves us money. It doesn't cost us money. It saves us trillions of dollars over the coming decade, because it gets rid of that massive, wasteful health insurance bureaucracy that's gobbling. ...30% of every healthcare dollar, and it stabilizes medical inflation to solve our national debt. If we look at this alone, we could solve our national debt crisis by implementing austerity or by creating health care for everyone as a human right. They would both save us the same amount of money. So how about it? How about health care as a solution to our debt crisis? And we need to forgive the crushing student debt burden and liberate an entire generation of young people who've been turned into indentured servants. And we will provide tuition-free public education from pre-kindergarten through college. Investing in college education, free public higher education, that saves us money as well. We know from the GI Bill, we've already done this. For every dollar we invest, we get $7 in return in benefits to the economy. We do have the money to do this. We don't have the money not to do it. The Green New Deal also creates a financial system that's free from domination by the big banks and well-connected financiers who've hijacked both our economy and our democracy. Instead, we'll create a system that's open, honest, stable, and serves the real economy, not the phony economy of high finance. We'll end the bailouts and the corporate giveaways and ensure that the resources are available for investing in our communities, for consumers, for small businesses and worker cooperatives. We'll break up the big banks that are too big to fail. We'll restore the separation of commercial and speculative banks, regulate all financial derivatives, democratize the monetary supply, and tax capital gains like income, tax Wall Street transactions, and put a 90% tax on the banker bonuses for the bailed out bankers. And to secure those reforms, we also need a functioning democracy, which we don't have today. So to start with, we've got to end the domination of our elections by corporations and big money. We need a constitutional amendment to clarify corporations are not people. Money is not speech. The Green New Deal will also undercut the power of lobbyists and billionaires to control our election by enacting a voter bill of rights. It will guarantee a voter-marked paper ballot for all voting and that all votes are counted. It will bring simplified same-day voter registration to the nation so no qualified voter is barred from the polls. We'll replace partisan oversight of elections with nonpartisan election commissions. We'll restore the votes of 1.4 million African-American men who are barred from voting because they are ex-felons. And we will implement election reforms like instant runoff voting and proportional representation that more accurately reflect voter sentiment and take the fear out of voting. And we will take money out of politics and replace it with full public finance and free and equal access to the airwaves. And we will guarantee equal access to the ballot and to the debates for all qualified candidates. And I want to urge you right now to go to our website, jillstein.org. We've begun a petition drive as part of an initiative called Occupy the Commission on Presidential Debates, or Occupy the CPD, a private corporation run by the Democratic and Republican parties has no business cutting off full and fair debate that the American people deserve, and we are not going to stand for it. That fight has just begun in my campaigns at the state level in Massachusetts. Our campaigns have always been locked out of the debates, but we have always managed to fight our way in by mobilizing the public that wants a full and fair debate, and we are determined to do the same thing in this election. So I'll just mention a couple other quick things. That beyond the Green New Deal, we must also bring the troops and the war dollars home from the illegal and immoral wars, including the proliferating drone wars. And we do not want to bring the drones home. We want to retire the drones right now and bury them at sea. We need a foreign policy which is based not on militarism and the protection of oil resources. We need to replace that with a foreign policy based on diplomacy, established on the basis of respect for international law and human rights. We will restore our civil liberties by repealing the Un-American Patriot Act, the National Defense Authorization Act, H.R. 347, and other laws that criminalize protest and direct our police to spy on nonviolent dissenters. And we will work to end the failed and racist war on drugs, starting with legalizing marijuana and putting it into a safe regulatory framework. Because marijuana is a substance that is dangerous because it's illegal. It's not illegal because it's dangerous. It's not dangerous. And finally, I will end the bipartisan war on immigrants and stand up against the discriminatory laws like the remnants of Arizona's SB 1070 and stand up to the racist demagoguery that wrongly blames immigrants for the unemployment brought on by Wall Street's abuse of the economy. And I will end Obama's misnamed Secure Communities program, which has deported over 1 million immigrants, heartlessly splitting families and taking thousands of children away from their parents. With that track record, the Obama White House has been the most anti-immigrant administration in a century. And we will replace the so-called free trade agreements, which generate economic refugees in the first place. These will be replaced with fair trade agreements that respect workers in this country and in Latin America and stop generating an immigration crisis for the people who are forced to migrate. We need these solutions. People agree with them in large majorities in poll after poll. Why don't we have them? A big reason, as you know, are these fear campaigns of the past decade that have been telling us we have to just be quiet and vote your fears. But we've done that for long enough now. There's a 10-year track record here that shows us silence is not an effective political strategy. And in fact, the politics of fear has brought us everything we were afraid of. All those reasons we were told to be quiet, we've gotten in droves because we've been quiet. From the expanding war to the more massive Wall Street bailouts, the offshoring of our jobs, the expanding free trade agreements, the attack on our civil liberties and immigrant rights, the meltdown of the climate, it has all gotten much worse. In fact, even under Barack Obama, it has gotten worse. It's important to stand up to this fear-mongering and recognize it for what it is
a public relations campaign bought and paid for by the Wall Street parties intended to silence the political opposition. We need to stand up. It's time to answer the politics of fear with the politics of courage. As the Massachusetts radicals did when they took on the British East Indies Company and dumped the tea into the harbor and declared themselves free of King's Law. As Fighting Bob La Follette did with the Progressive Party and the People's Party and the Socialist Party, who stood up for workers' rights, for the right to unionize, for the 40-hour work week and safe working conditions. All of these movements forward required a social movement on the ground, and they required an independent political party to actually move the agenda forward, to bring those demands into the electoral realm, because without that, as Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did. It never will. That demand needs to be there in the realm of electoral politics. It's not enough to vote with your feet. You've also got to vote with your vote if you really want things to change. That's what this campaign is all about, standing up and reclaiming our political voice and our political courage. Because the moment we do, the American people can no longer be ignored. We'll have a base from which we can build, and we can start to drive forward the critical solutions that people broadly support, but which Wall Street politicians have kept off the table, and which we are the only vehicle for in this election. We'll give people a choice and a voice in the voting booth, and enable them to go to the polls and vote for the Green New Deal and the reforms that will improve our lives right now. I ask for your vote, and I ask for something more. Help us break into the debates. Help us raise money. Help form new Green Party locals all over the country. Ensure that the voice of principled opposition will be heard now and into the future by standing up and pushing forward with this campaign for economic and political democracy. We signal to the world that we, the people, the 99%, have taken the political stage in the United States of America once again, and we will take the lead in our democracy. We will create an unstoppable movement together, and we won't rest until we turn the White House into a greenhouse and take back the promise of democracy and the peaceful, just, green future we deserve. Thank you all so much. Carry on, Wisconsin. Woo!
Speaking of a greenhouse, our next speaker is the author of a dozen books on the environment, beginning with The End of Nature in 1989, which is regarded as the first book for a general audience on climate change. He is the founder of the grassroots climate campaign 350.org, which has coordinated 15,000 rallies in 189 countries since 2009. It's really not hyperbole to say he's been perhaps the single most effective person in the world in raising awareness and marshaling action to combat this most fundamental issue that we face, climate change. Notably, recently, he was one of the people who brought the plans for the Keystone Pipeline to a halt. After leading the largest demonstration in the country's history on climate change, he writes beautifully in his books and as a longtime contributor to The New Yorker under the editorship of William Shawn. And he puts his words into action, working tirelessly to do as much as one person can possibly do to save the world. I give you Bill McKibben.
It's so good to hear Bill Shawn there. Good for you. Well, now what a great pleasure for me to be here and to bring you greetings from my home state of Vermont, where we have the present-day incarnation of Bob La Follette serving in the U.S. Senate from our little state. Now, I wish he was here to talk. He is a great orator, although the last time he stood up on the Senate floor, he went on for 8.5 hours, so perhaps just as well. you've been hearing great orators all day, great stem-winding speeches like that last one that were really good, and I'm afraid for me you get very little of that. I'm, you know, a writer, not a talker particularly. And anyway, after all the good fiery things, you've been hearing and all the kind of up and enthusiasm, it sort of reminds me that one of my roles in the world is just to be a professional bummer outer of people, you know, and bring them news they just as soon always not hear. I'll only do that for a minute, and then I'll get on for just another minute to what we're going to do about some of this stuff. But it is important. I mean, it just reality intrudes all the time. The most important thing that happened this year isn't going to turn out even to have been the presidential election, probably. And the most important thing that happened this year was that half the Arctic ice cap melted in the course of the last 6 months. There's literally, we broke and smashed every possible record. One of the biggest physical features on the planet got broken this year by us. This summer in the U.S. was a summer to remember, a summer like no one we've ever had, a summer really that began, as you might recall, last March, when in the end of the month, all of a sudden, it was 85 degrees across the upper Midwest, you know, in South Dakota, the 2 days before the end of winter, it was 94 degrees. And then that, it must be said, kind of good, you know, break out the shorts and the t-shirt and wander around. But if it felt good in some ways, it felt weird and kind of scary in other ways. And there was no way not to feel in the back of your mind that this was really not how the world was supposed to work. And of course, that became remarkably clear a few weeks later when all the fruit trees and flowers that had gone into early bloom were wiped out by the typical April frost. And there's a lot fewer apples and cherries and things than there should be coming out of this part of the world. That was just warming up when we got to summer. You'll recall what happened. You'll recall forest fires bigger than we'd ever seen in New Mexico and Colorado. And then that epic heat that started drifting across the country, setting records place after place after place after place. And that huge storm that swept west to east, knocking out power to 5 million people as it went from Indianapolis to D.C. in the course of a day. And then the drought that settled in across this country. 68% of our country is currently federal drought disaster area. Every single inch of the state of Wisconsin is a disaster area. Wisconsin! Madeline Perra, our great 350 Madison leader, I hope she may have gone home to do. Hopefully she hears some. There she is. She handed me this thing from the Weather Service. It turns out that of all the states in the Union that were having weird weather this year, Wisconsin led them all. Wisconsin set more high temperature records than any. I mean, there were, I think, some people in this room who predicted that if you would elect Scott Walker, this place would go to hell in a handbasket, but maybe not quite so literally, you know. That's hot. That's too hot. It's happening all over the world, and it's happening even and especially in those places that have done nothing to cause the trouble that we're in. Places where people haven't ever felt any of the benefits of fossil fuel, just the suffering. And unless we act really quickly, it's going to get much, 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 much worse. Everything that I described, half the Arctic melted, comes with a 1 degree rise in temperature. The same scientists who told us that would happen
Tell us with confidence that we will raise the temperature 4 or 5 degrees in the course of this century unless we get off coal and oil and gas far sooner than any government currently plans. And we simply can't do that. The world will not work. The world will break if we keep doing that. The agronomists tell us that from this point on, every degree rise in global temperature will cut grain yields 10%. You saw across the Midwest this summer exactly how that's possible. Price of food is up 40 and 50% around the world, the price of grain in the last 8 or 9 weeks. For us, we can probably deal with it, most of us. You go buy a box of cornflakes, you pay more for the box than for the corn, you know. But if you get up someplace every morning, as most of the world does, and has to make your way to the market and find enough coins to buy cornmeal to make tortillas for your family for dinner, it means you're eating less than you want tonight, a lot less. And that's true all over the place. We can't let this happen anymore. We cannot let it get any worse, which means we have to fight. And the good news is we're starting to fight. There are battles now going on all over the place about all the crazy things we're doing to rip the last bits of oil and gas and coal out. People, brave people, fighting mountaintop removal in the Appalachians. Brave people up and down the East Coast fighting fracking, and here in Wisconsin trying to stop the kind of endless export of, say, you have this special fracking sand that they need, and so they're strip mining parts of Wisconsin in order that they can blow up parts of Pennsylvania and New York, you know. And the fight we had about this pipeline down out of the tar sands of Canada. A fight we started because Jim Hansen at NASA, our greatest climatologist, said, you know what, you might want to pay attention to this because there's more. If we took all the economically recoverable oil out of those Alberta tar sands and burned it, that would be more carbon than we've burning everything that humans have burnt in all of human time till now. We would raise the atmospheric concentration of CO2 from 395 parts per million to 540 parts per million. But that did not stop anybody, government or industry, from wanting to go ahead and do this. The only thing that stopped it was when people rose up. When people came, if there's people maybe here who came to Washington to help, I wish you'd stand up for a second so we can see you and say thanks. People came to Washington. It turned into the largest civil disobedience action in 30 years in this country. And 1,253 people got arrested over 2 weeks, and that was really good to see. That might be what it takes some of the time, you know. It taught us not that, there's no guarantee, by the way, that this temporary victory we won is going to last. All environmental victories are temporary. This one may be more so than most because the oil industry is pouring everything it has to try and overturn it. Mitt Romney has announced that were he elected, his very first act on his first day in office would be to approve the Keystone Pipeline. That would be the most important thing he could think of. Barack Obama has not made clear exactly what will happen if he's reelected. There are no guarantees, okay? The only thing that we know for sure that came out of that fight was the understanding that it is possible to stand up to the fossil fuel industry. Yes, they are the richest industry on earth, and they have more money than God, you know. But when we find other currencies to work in, passion and spirit and creativity, the kind of currencies of movements, if we're willing to spend our bodies sometimes, then we can stand up some of the time. Now what we have to do is figure out how to do that more efficiently, because there are too many pipelines and too many coal mines and too many oil wells and too many fracking rigs for us to one by one take them down. There just are not enough. It's like the little Dutch boy trying to stick. We run out of fingers, and so it's time, I guess, to sort of make a fist a little bit instead, you know, and start standing up more directly to the fossil fuel industry. try to figure out how we're going to go at the center of that industry, because they are a rogue industry. I wrote a piece for Rolling Stone this summer that, oddly enough, sort of went viral. It became the most shared piece in the magazine's history, and all it did was lay out this map, you know, just relatively straightforward. 2 degrees is the one thing that the world's leaders have agreed on, even the United States, you know, and all the other countries in the world said 2 degrees would be more than, that's where we should draw the, no, it's too high, 1 degree melted the Arctic, but 2 degrees is what everybody's agreed on. We know how much carbon about you can put in the atmosphere and have any hope of staying below it, 565 more gigatons of carbon. It would take us about 16 years at the rate which we're currently burning carbon to go past that as a planet, okay? So that's bad news. But the worst news, the really impossible news, was the third of these three numbers in that piece. It's 2,795 gigatons. That's how much carbon the fossil fuel industry, it turns out, has in its reserves ready to burn. 5 times more than the most conservative governments say is possible to pour into the atmosphere, but they're going to do it. That's what they're, you know, that's what Exxon's share price is based on, its reserves. When Peabody Coal borrows money, that's what they borrow money against. That's their collateral. That's going to get burnt unless we stop them. These guys are outlaws. They are not outlaws against the laws of the state. They write the laws of the state, okay? But they are outlaws against the laws of physics and chemistry. And it is up to us right now to figure out how to bring them, well, I guess, to justice in a sense. We can't, at least exclusively, do it politically, because our political system is, to a large degree, owned by those guys. That's what happens when you allow people to spend unlimited amounts of money. People who have unlimited amounts of money come to own the system. There was a story in yesterday's Times about how the fossil fuel industry is spending far more than any other industry in this year's elections, as they almost always do. And that's why in Washington we have had a perfect 20-year bipartisan record of accomplishing nothing on climate change. Okay? Constantly going to Washington is sort of the same mistake that you make if you have a problem with, like, a store, and you call up the store and they say, oh, you know, press 1 for customer service, and you press 1 and you hold the phone to your ear and you listen to the bad music for a while. If they put you on hold for 20 years, it is probably smart at some point to hang up, okay? And then go say, we've actually got to talk to the guy who owns the store, you know. Go to the back room. I'm tired of talking to the cashier. We need to talk to the Koch brothers. We need to talk to Exxon. And the only language these guys understand, the only thing they care about, the only thing that moves them is money. So the only way to reach them is to say, we're going to try and take away a little bit of it. You know, you want to take away the future of the planet, we will take away your money. Okay? Now, that's not an easy thing to do. The system is wired in their favor, but there have been moments in the past when we've been able to do some of this. And one of the best examples of those was 25 years ago, when people, beginning in college towns, but all over this country, came together to figure out how to force money out of companies that did business in South Africa. And that divestment movement that spread around the country eventually convinced several hundred colleges and universities to do the right thing, and churches and pension funds and lots of other places, and it had an enormous effect. When Nelson Mandela got out of prison on Robben Island, one of the first foreign trips he took was to the United States. And he did not rush off to the White House, and he did not rush off to the State Department. When he got here, the first places he came were some of those college campuses. And he said, we liberated ourselves in South Africa, but what you guys did was an enormous help. It made it much, much easier for us to do it. That pressure works. So beginning the night after the election, we're launching a road show at 350 that will go all around the country, 25 cities in 25 nights. I'm already feeling tired just contemplating it. And it'll wash up here, I believe, on November 29th. And it's going to be fun. It'll be much more, to your great relief, it won't just be me speaking. There'll be lots of other good people speaking at various points along the way. Naomi Klein will be with us for a while, and Van Jones, and lots of good people, friends of ours, and lots of music and video and things. But it's going to try and light a bunch of fires all over the country, sort of brush fires, getting people involved in this divestment thing and pushing hard on the fossil fuel industry in other creative ways. Circle the dates in the spring for the shareholder meetings of these big fossil fuel companies, because we may need you down in St. Louis and Dallas and the places where they meet in order to bring this message there. Okay, we're going to see what we can do. Now, I cannot promise you it's going to work, but I can promise you it's going to be interesting to start pushing on them, to start making the point that they're not respected members of our business community, that they are outlaws, that their social license needs to be revoked, that they're behaving with the kind of recklessness it's almost impossible to imagine. And if people, I assume that there's probably few people in this audience who might be, if not currently at the university, might be alumni of the university, yeah? Or of some other college or university or someplace, you know? You guys have a huge role to play. If young people get things going, we're going to need everybody backing them up in serious ways. And I want to end just by telling you two lessons that I learned from that keystone, from that civil disobedience that we did, okay? Because I think they're important and worth, at least for me, worth remembering. The first one has to do with that multi-generational nature of things, okay? When I wrote this letter asking people to come down to Washington to get arrested, one of the things I said in it was, young people should not have to be the cannon fodder in this fight, okay? They've led the climate fight all along, and they'll continue to lead it, and that's great and appropriate. But if you're 22 in our economy, you know, really an arrest record may not be the number one thing you want on your resume as you go to look for work. One of the few advantages of growing older is, past a certain point, what the hell are they going to do to you? You know? And so I was pleased to see, as people arrived in Washington, there were plenty of young people, but there were also a number of people whose, you know, hairline looked sort of like mine, sort of follicularly challenged, you know, would appear. And we didn't actually ask people, how old are you, as they were getting arrested, because that would be rude. But cleverly, we said, who was president when you were born? Okay. And the two biggest cohorts have been born in the FDR and the Truman administrations. Okay. So that's good news. And for the young people here, it means that your elders are stepping up, and I think will continue to do so. And I have no doubt that if the day comes when there are 100 students sitting in outside the Board of Trustees office here, that there will be 500 older people out there with them and protecting them and in solidarity with them. And I gotta say, this was for me, the first time I ever went off to jail. I only spent 3 days in Central Cell Block in D.C., which was, you know, as much fun as it sounds like it would be. But it wasn't the end of the world. The end of the world is the end of the world, okay? And that's sort of what we're trying to do something about here. The second lesson that was important to me that when we did these arrests, second thing that I thought was interesting, is I said, if you want to come get arrested. I'd be grateful if you'd show up in a necktie or dress, you know. This is how I normally dress. I neckties are mostly for funerals and things in my world. But we wanted to send a visual point that I think is extremely important, which is that there is nothing radical at all about what we're asking for here, okay? Nothing. We're asking for a world that works a little bit the way, you know, it did when we were born, which is, if you think about it, a kind of conservative thing to be asking. I don't think there's anything radical about what Occupy is asking for. I think they're sort of saying, we'd like a world that works a little bit the way it was told it would in our civics class, you know, not endlessly rigged in favor of the powerful. I don't think there's anything radical about what we're asking for. Radicals work at oil companies. If you are willing to get up every day and amass your fortune altering the chemical composition of the atmosphere, then you are engaged in an act more radical than any human before you has engaged in. Okay? And we need to say that and call people out on it and put a stop to that kind of radicalism. I'm not guaranteeing you we can do it. They've got an awful lot of money, and the time is awfully short. But I know, because I have spent so much time now around the world, and we operate in every country but North Korea now. And, I know that there are people all over the world ready to make this fight. Many of them didn't cause this problem, but they're willing to help solve it, you know. And that kind of movement, if it gets going, if it really, then there's at least the chance of things changing. So no guarantee of victory, but the guarantee of a fight. It's always a great honor for me to be in those rooms all over the world with people who are engaged in it. It is a signal honor to get to be in this room with y'all, because I know how much you've done in the past, and I know how much you will do in the future. And I just look forward to doing it with you, shoulder to shoulder. Thank you all so much.
Well, it's been an incredibly inspiring day, hasn't it? We have one more speaker, one last speaker who needs absolutely no introduction in this room, but I get to give him one anyway, so that's kind of fun. John Nichols, my good friend, has written a book on Wisconsin, as you all know, Uprising. He has been the voice of Wisconsin. You read him in The Nation, you see him on MSNBC, and he speaks for all of us. And it has been an incredible time. And thanks to his leadership, a lot of the nation knows about what's happening here in a way that they wouldn't otherwise. I got to go to Tampa for the RNC and pal around with Nichols quite a bit during that weird week. And as you all probably know, one of the great things about John is he loves to have fun and is busy and as famous as he is always ready to stop and chat and hang out and just find fun, stupid things to do, as he likes to say. So one of the fun and stupid things that we did in Tampa was to get on a yacht with Tommy Thompson for a big old fundraiser for Tommy's campaign. We figured, hey, it's for Wisconsin, it's a party, we're from Wisconsin, and we just walked on board. In fact, the only thing you needed to get on this yacht was a Wisconsin driver's license, which both of us happen to have. So we went right up the gangplank, we were right at the door to the yacht, and unfortunately, the great cost that John has paid for being so famous is he was recognized, and he was hung up at the door, and he kind of elbowed me to keep walking while he was talked to by people who were looking at him and thinking, something's not right about this. But fortunately, the other great thing about John is he's friends with absolutely everybody, and he is so easy to get along with. He just flung an arm around Haley Barbour and walked onto that yacht. And during the speeches by all of these prominent Republican national figures, it makes you cringe to even be in the same room with, he was recognized by Tommy Thompson, who shouted out, how the hell did you get on here, Nichols? Tommy was delighted to see John. John was delighted to see Tommy. And the whole scene was just insane. So I have to say, the sheer force of John's good cheer and optimism, I think, is going to carry us a long way in this bizarre political environment that we're in. And so I'm very happy to give you John Nichols.
All right. There you go. All right. Brothers and sisters! Brothers and sisters! We have reached the point where everything has been said, but not everyone has said it yet. And I want to tell you that when you want to talk about the sublime to the ridiculous, you put Bill McKibben speaking before John Nichols. Ladies and gentlemen, another round of applause for one of the great heroes of civil disobedience on behalf of our planet and on behalf of our future, on behalf of my child's future and her children's future. Bill McKibben, follow this man. Follow Bill McKibben as we hold the next president to account, no matter who it is. Bill McKibben, the 350 movement. That's right. I cannot believe I'm in the same room with my absolute hero, Terry O'Neill from the National Organization for Women. Terry O'Neill from the National Organization for Women. But I want to tell you, we always have announcements, and there's simply no way that we get going here without saying that it is an absolute moral responsibility in this republic to free Bradley Manning. Free the whistleblowers. Make sure that those who tell the truth about what is done are not punished for doing so. Number two, speaking of telling the truth, Amy Goodman's coming to town next week. If you're not going to see Amy Goodman, you're not a true Bob Fester. She's going to be September 20th at the Barrymore Theater. Don't miss it. If you have not been to the table of Tanya Lore, I want to tell you, I make no political endorsements, but if there is a work of the good Lord, it must be running against good Glenn Grothman. And finally, last year, Bob Fest was asked to take on a mission. And that was to sign postcards and ask Coca-Cola to quit the American Legislative Exchange Council. It was the first popular action to get a corporation to leave ALEC. 3,000 people at Bob Fest last year signed postcards, and Coca-Cola quit ALEC, one of the first corporations to leave ALEC. It left when Bob Fest said it is time to go, holding corporations to account. Now, these same people are out here, and they got a new duty. They want you to sign a postcard to tell State Farm, the insurance company that we are supposed to own, we who have State Farm policies are supposed to own, tell State Farm to leave ALEC now. Let's take another big institution out of ALEC. Let's take corporate power down. Let's say right now from Bob Fest, we don't allow you to remain in this entity which forces immoral laws on the states across this country. Sign a postcard. Let's make this ALEC exposed movement that started here go nationwide, go worldwide. Let's take it to ALEC and make sure that their power is taken down. And finally, while we're at it, you have seen people walking through this room wearing the Robin Hood hat. Yesterday afternoon, Congressman Keith Ellison of Minnesota introduced the most robust tax on financial speculation ever introduced to the Congress of the United States, a Robin Hood tax that says that those who push paper on Wall Street should pay their fair share. Keith Ellison's Robin Hood tax would create $400 billion in revenue for the United States annually with a tiny tax on stock and bond transactions. You want to talk about how we replace fossil fuels? You want to talk about how we replace these big multinational corporations and having to bend to them so they'll give us a little bit of tax money? Well, I've got the answer. Brothers and sisters, it's time to tax the speculators. A Robin Hood tax. Take it from Wall Street. Give it to the people. And that's what Whitman would tell you to do as well. Now, I'm not going to give a long speech because so much good stuff has been said. But I do want to remind you of something that happened the better part of 80 years ago, 90 years ago. Robert M. La Follette, for whom this event is named, Robert M. La Follette voted against allowing the United States to go to war in World War I. He said that the sons of farmers and shopkeepers in Wisconsin, the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren of those who had fought a revolution against the British king and against empire, should not sacrifice their lives in a war between kings and kaisers. It was not our job to go around the world fighting distant wars that were not our business. Robert M. La Follette was hung in effigy. He was hung in effigy on the campus of the University of Wisconsin. He was condemned by the U.S. Senate. He was ridiculed in the media of the country. He was even kicked out of the university club at the UW. The Madison Club as well. Now that, admittedly, that may be a benefit for the average person. But he was pilloried for this action. 4 years later, in 1921, it was time for him to launch his campaign for re-election to the U.S. Senate. Robert M. La Follette went to the assembly chamber at the state capitol. His aides said to him as he walked into that chamber, "Bob, people have started to forget about the war. Yeah, we lost 90,000 kids. Yeah, we buried so many of our sons. Yeah, we've got people shell-shocked and injured and wounded still walking our streets. But people are starting to put the war behind them. You've got to do the same. Don't talk about the war, Bob. Don't talk about your opposition. It was the most controversial thing you ever did. Talk about other things. Talk about people, things that people want to hear. Talk about the easy stuff." And Bob La Follette nodded, and then he walked to the podium in that packed assembly chamber. And he said, "I know I'm supposed to give a big address here, but I want to say something right up front so that if people who don't like what I say up front need to leave, they can. I regret nothing about my opposition to World War I. It was an immoral war, and if you do not stand with me on that, then I do not want to stand with you on any other issue. I was right. They were wrong. That war was immoral." His aides were apoplectic. They were like, "Oh my gosh, Bob, you've sacrificed the Senate seat." No. When people went to vote the following November, Robert M. La Follette was re-elected to office with 78% of the vote, the largest percentage ever given to a Senate candidate in the state of Wisconsin. And I stand before you today to say that I know over the last several years, last 18, 19 months at least, we have had our ups and downs in Wisconsin. We've had victories and we've had defeats. But I regret nothing about the struggle to hold Scott Walker to account and to reassert the rights of labor and the rights of the people in Wisconsin. I regret nothing. We were right and they were wrong. We were right and they were wrong. We fought the good fight, and that fight carries forward. And I know, look, I know there are people who will say to you, "Well, but what did we get out of it? What has come of this great struggle in Wisconsin?" Well, you know, Bill McKibben comes here and he tells us we're his heroes. And I'm thinking to myself, boy, if we're Bill McKibben's heroes, we've done more good than we could ever imagine. Terry O'Neill says the same thing, so many of our friends. But let me tell you what we did here in Wisconsin. We renewed a labor movement that did not know how to fight against corporations and corporate power. The labor movement across this country is different and better because we went to the streets of Madison and communities across this state. We renewed the labor movement. It is fighting harder and better because of what we did in Wisconsin. We inspired an ALEC exposed movement to show how corporations are controlling our legislatures, and that movement has forced Walmart and the biggest companies in this nation to change their approach, to leave ALEC because we exposed what they did. That came out of Madison, Wisconsin, from the Center for Media and Democracy that said no corporations running our legislatures. We inspired our friends in Ohio to stand up and say that their anti-labor law was wrong and it needed to be overturned at the ballot. They filed more than a million signatures. They forced that referendum. And on referendum day, 61% of the people in Ohio voted to protect labor rights, not corporate rights. Oh, and when Paul Ryan came back to Wisconsin, found us on the map, when Paul Ryan came back to Wisconsin to do his town hall meetings to explain his plan to gut Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, Greg Pallister, you're going to appreciate this. When Paul Ryan came back to Wisconsin thinking he was going to be welcomed as the heroic son of our state, he went to those town hall meetings in Milton and in Kenosha and in Lake Geneva, and instead of being welcomed as a conquering hero for the corporate class, he was called out by old ladies in tennis shoes who said, "I don't believe you, Paul Ryan. We learned to fight here in Wisconsin, and we're going to show the rest of the country how to shut down an austerity agenda that would attack our Social Security, our Medicare, our Medicaid." The reason we're winning this fight is because people from Wisconsin confronted Paul Ryan first, and aren't we thankful to Mitt Romney for not noticing our struggle and putting Paul Ryan on the ticket? Because, brothers and sisters, when you see those ads over the next 50 days with those pictures of Paul Ryan, understand this is the first time in the history of the Republic that a vice presidential candidate is going to defeat his own ticket. For brothers and sisters, the most important thing, and we don't get the credit for it, and we never will, because the great fights never get the credit. It won't be remembered that Bill spent those 3 days in jail. It won't be, unless he writes a Henry David Thoreau book about it. But what I want you to understand, something that happened here in the state of Wisconsin. On June 5th of this year, a people's movement recalled and removed the last legislator who was in position to allow Scott Walker to go forward with his agenda. Since 2010, when the Republican wave swept in, one state has checked and balanced a Republican governor by taking away his legislative control. That is the state of Wisconsin. Do not ever let them tell you that the recall movement did not work. We stopped Scott Walker from advancing his agenda. Yes, it would have been great to vote him out as well. But brothers and sisters, he has not been able to advance right to work. He has not been able to push forward with his voter ID laws. They have not been able to do what they would have done if they had held the legislature. You created a movement that checked and balanced the most powerful, most well-funded governor in the United States, and you have changed the politics of this state and this nation as a result. Do not ever let them tell you that you have not been victorious, because Scott Walker is not calling the shots today in Wisconsin. This is hard work, brothers and sisters. I know it's a lot to ask. It's a lot to ask that you be involved in a long-term struggle. It's so much easier to win one election, to win one convention. But we're not about candidates and parties in this movement. We're not about a politics that goes with the self-gratification of one moment and one victory. Yeah, it'd be great if we could get it. This is about a long-term struggle. Robert M. La Follette said, democracy is a life. What he meant by that is that you don't get to stop fighting just because you're tired. You don't get to stop fighting just because you got beat. You don't get to stop fighting just because the other side has a lot of money. You don't get to stop fighting just because the media is so arrayed against you. You don't get to stop fighting because you're fighting for economic and social justice, and you don't stop fighting until you get justice. That's the point of the struggle. And so we fight on. We don't let them tell us to slow down or stop. And the good Lord watches that. And you know what? The rewards come. Because when you fight on, when you struggle through the hard times, when you take the attacks, when you take the hits, and you keep on marching, not just at the ballot box, but in the streets, when you keep on pushing forward, sometimes on the night before Bobfest, and I don't care if you are an atheist or a theist or a deist, I don't care if you're Tom Jefferson or Tom Paine, I'm going to tell you something. When on the night before Bobfest, a judge strikes down the Act 10 law of Scott Walker, you have got to believe something incredible is happening. It is beyond explanation. It is beyond comprehension. It is beyond our own will. We have the will of the world with us because we're on the right side. We are bending the arc of history toward justice. And brothers and sisters, I'm holding in my hand the most beautiful document since the American Constitution. Might throw the Emancipation Proclamation in as well. This is the judge's ruling. The founders of this republic were pretty smart. They created a system of checks and balances. They said the power does not rest in one king. Power does not even rest in that king's legislature. Power is divided, and judges have the power to check and balance autocratic governors and to tell them they are not in charge. The law applies to them as well. And so we kept our movement going long enough to be told that when we stood out there with those signs in February and March of 2011 and we said, this is about our rights, we were right. We were right. They laughed at us. Even some of our allies said, oh, come on, you know, you can't possibly make that case. But the fact of the matter is, I've got 27 pages right here, detailed with footnotes, that says, when we made that case, people with an ounce of common sense heard what we were saying. And this is important. This is the most important thing I'll say to you. When the United States occupied Japan and Germany after World War II, MacArthur and Eisenhower helped to write or organize the writing of the constitutions of those occupied states. They brought the people in. They encouraged them. But they said some things have to be in these constitutions. You've got to have a media that is publicly controlled and that is independent from corporations and private ownership, because the people have to have information. They have to have information. So they have better media in Japan and Germany, because we said you got to have better media if you're going to be a democracy. But they said something else. In the constitutions of Japan and Germany, they said free trade unions have a right to organize their workplaces and to collectively bargain on behalf of the workers. We were right to say it to the rest of the world, brothers and sisters, but this ruling says that Scott Walker violated the basic premises of the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, the right to freedom of association, the right to assemble, the right to petition for the redress of grievances. Those constitutional rights are accorded to trade unionists. We are bringing our message to the world back home to America, and we are saying from Wisconsin, this state shall lead as we assert once and for all that the workers have the right to collectively bargain, and we can use that right, use our unions to stand up and push back against corporate power. This state is going to lead the United States to a higher ground. We have begun the turning point. It started last night, brothers and sisters, but we couldn't celebrate at a better place than in the light of Robert M. La Follette and Ed Garvey and all of you, because I will tell you this. I will tell you this. We have come so far through so much for so long, but we are here. And I don't mean we in this room. I mean we, the people of Wisconsin. We are here because you, the people in this room, gave your blood, your sweat, and your tears for a movement that you were told was impossible. This movement is not impossible. This movement is inevitable. And Robert M. La Follette tells you that. I tell you that. You know it. Go out. Go out, brothers and sisters, and make the change that is worthy of the history of this state. Do not seek to go back to what we had in January of 2011. Let's take it forward. This movement, the progressive movement, was formed in the 19th century. It was forged in the 20th century. Let its promise be realized in the 21st century. Brothers and sisters, our time has come. It is now. March on. Solidarity. 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 We will not back down because we are right. Solidarity.
Anybody want to follow that? Lynette Jandel, we have your wallet at the stage, so if you're coming to get it, Lynette, we're taking all the money out of it and putting it in the bucket if you're not here in the next 5 minutes. So, Lynette Jandel, we have two sets of car keys. One, I suspect, was that double 666 this morning. It's a Honda, and this one is an unlock. I don't know what the hell it is. Anyway, if you're missing your car keys.
Don't worry, Ed. We'll get them. They know they're here. Go ahead. They know they're here. Say your stuff.
Let us understand one thing. The beer is still available, so now we can buy one for somebody. Hightower skipped out without buying us a beer, so shame on him. Let's just give a round of applause for the staff for putting this together, because they have done a marvelous job. And even some are related, and don't deny it. So I want to thank all of you, because it's been an honor to be here and to listen to what a group of speakers we have put together. And when we get the videotapes, have your friends and neighbors over and have them watch it and get them to do something. We need to have your email address, phone number, so please email to us at fightingbob.com, the best way to get in touch with you, so you can get all of the information that we have coming to you. I don't know what else to say in closing except thank you, Ruth, for doing a great job as the co-chair. But you shouldn't have done so good that you made me look foolish. I mean, I just think this is crazy. And John Nichols, I think if he would just take some of those power drinks, perhaps he could get a little more excited. So thanks to all the speakers. McKibben is leading the battle that we have to win. If we win, if we don't win it, the planet is done for. So I hope you will not only listen and take the lead with Bill McKibben, but join the organization and be out there when they come to Wisconsin and go to jail if necessary. We can't lose this battle. So, Bill McKibben, we appreciate you being here. Count on us as soldiers in that army. For all the rest of you, time to have a beer. I don't even know where the beer is served, which gives you some idea of what's wrong with me.
With America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome to the 10th day of September 2012. This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com. I'm Bob Kincaid. And what we do here, we could like to call conversation radio. The Horn is available easily across a wide variety of platforms on the interweb tubes. Remember, it's not a big truck. You can get The Horn simply by going to headonradionetwork.com and clicking Listen Live at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific. That will take you directly to the live program. During the rest of the day, it'll take you to the rerun stream, which goes pretty much 24/7 unless our internet web tube service thingy here craps out on us. And we try to get it started again as soon as possible in those instances. It's a very small operation. No, that's the easiest way. You can also find the link to the stream at whiterosesociety.org, where for around 10 years now, Ben Birch has literally been saving progressive radio. whiterosesociety.org. We're available also at TuneIn Radio, one of the more popular, as I understand it, one of the more popular progressive, liberal, what have you, radio programs there at TuneIn. We're also available at Stitcher Internet Radio and at Tuner Internet Radio. Still working on dar.fm, but hopefully that'll come along in due time. Go ahead and say it and get it out of the way. The Horn is an enterprise that is entirely listener-supported. Entirely. If y'all don't do it, there ain't no show. Ain't no horn. Ain't no program. And with that in mind, we rely upon your contributions via the PayPal button at headonradionetwork.com or the snail mail address, which is equally available there under the tab Contribute. If you look, if you go and you look, you will find that this is, well, as I explained on Friday in a show that can only be best described by our buddy Scott in Sweden. He described Friday's show as gloomy. And it was. It was. There's no getting around it. But if you look at the target bar on the front page of The Horn, headonradionetwork.com, you'll see that we're halfway to taking care of the month of September. Now, in order to make that an accurate number, you need to subtract about $320 from that, because
part of that was the airfare for me to get to the Fighting Bob Fest that was just put in through PayPal and was not part of ordinary monthly fundraising. So we're almost to halfway. And that's good, because this will be a shortened week. My apologies. We will have a More End Monday show tonight. Yes, I have not forgotten, because we've got some More Ends in the offing. And we will have a show tomorrow night for Titanic Tuesday. But no show on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. I am in the air to Wisconsin. And Saturday is the Fightin' Bob Fest. And we are still working on details to see if I'm going to be able to at least stream the Fightin' Bob Fest festivities. If there are interweb tubes available in the venue, I will try to stream the addresses and the addresses, the plenary sessions, I guess you would call it. But that's an all-day affair on Saturday. I fly back to Washington, D.C. on Sunday, and we hope to have regular shows Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, etc., unless one of them happens to be a travel day. So that's the schedule going forward, and I hope we don't fall behind in fundraising, because, as I explained, the outlook has become rather grim going forward. All the funding sources that we had that made up, that we used to make up shortfall, buy groceries, things like that, have dried up. And as such, just keeping this on the air is going to become a Herculean undertaking. And toward meeting that goal, I will tell you this evening that our dear friend, good friend, Dr. John, formerly of New York, now of North Carolina, has put his monthly $50 challenge on the table. In other words, John has $50 that he will match the first $50 that come in any combination, so that some combination of $50 in contributions becomes, via John, Dr. John, becomes $100. And that would be monumental. So that's what hopefully will happen this evening. Dr. John's challenge, $50, to meet the first $50 that come in, thereby turning 50 into 100. John having noted in offering this month's challenge, he said earlier today, trying to call it up here. Come on, little computer. There we go. Yeah. He said, that's the impetus. I can't lose a forum where I can say impotence with impudence. And really, when you stop and think about it, how many of those are there? I'd like to think that this program probably has a higher vocabulary score than most others. You know, it was announced that Michelle Obama's convention speech 2 weeks ago, or last week rather, it all runs together after a while. Michelle Obama's convention speech was actually written, or graded out, I should say. I don't think it was necessarily consciously written, but it graded out on a 12th grade level. That is the highest. The absolutely highest that any First Lady's speech has ever graded in the history of First Lady's speechmaking at political conventions. By the same token, and this really does tell you, it probably tells you more about the perceived audiences for the speech than it does about the speechmakers themselves. Whereas Michelle Obama's speech was delivered at a 12th grade level, which really is when you consider that fully one-third of American high school students do not finish high school. That's pretty ambitious at 12th grade level. On the other hand, the lowest ever vocabulary level for any first lady making a speech at a political convention was also delivered this year. It was delivered by Bishop Willard Romney's wife, Anne, who delivered a speech whose vocabulary level was at the fifth grade. What does that tell you about audiences? I think it's fairly obvious. The Republicans, when they give a speech, they have to talk really, really slowly and use little itsy bitsy teensy tiny words. And they probably have to speak with pronounced lip movement so that the morons of the Republican Party can understand. I like smart. And as a consequence, I favored Mrs. Obama's speech. Not to mention the fact that, as noted in a previous program, I don't like having some millionaire's wife explain to me how her marriage is more real than mine. F you, Ann, okay? Just saying. Or go to hell. Or Kolob. I don't give a damn. Smarmy, smug. I'm sure that was incivil, wasn't it? Oopsie! But that's why, I think we probably do have a little higher level discourse on this program than, any right-wing program out there. Because a right-wing radio person, again, just like Ann Romney, has to use little bitty monosyllabic short words so as not to confuse the morons. Right? Right. So where do we go this evening? Oh, that's easy. That's real easy. Oh, by the way, have you ever been to the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com chat room? It's free and easy. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/chatroom, registration, boom, you're right there. And room is filling up. Greg's come in. Jug of Punch is there. Our chat room moderators, Lottie and Sparky, are there. Sal's there. And more will wander in as the program progresses. We're liberals. We're progressives. We're not necessarily going to be standing there pounding on the doors right there at showtime. We wander in at our convenience. No, really, I have not forgotten what this day is. No, not at all.
You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land. You know, morons.
That's right, hurry, 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 step right up, right here, for less than 5 cents per hour of programming. You, too, can gaze behind this thin cybernetic veil of cybernetic canvas. It's Moran Monday on the Horn, and you can't tell the morons without a program. This, of course, is the program that tries to tell the morons, the only problem being you just can't tell a moron much. It is Moran Monday on the Horn. Women and small children are advised to, women are advised to hang on to their purses, men to their wallets, and small children, well, they just won't be admitted. No one will be admitted to the More End Monday tent show after for the first 5 minutes. Head for the hills or you'll be up to your armpits in More Ends.
Oh, God, ain't it the truth. I'm just here, Sandra, now. Yeah, you're going to have to keep that circus music going for a while, Bob. Jesus. Yes. For our first Moran this evening, I'm torn. Do we go with Piyush Jindal? Emmett C. Burns Jr. No, really, Mr. Burns. Excellent. Do we go with Mr. Burns, or do we go with Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist? I'm rich, I'm comfortably well off, I'm socially secure. My first inclination is to go with Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist. I may be a coward, but I'm a greedy coward. I don't know who the person who booked Rand Paul opposite Paul Krugman was, but they've got a future in booking wrestling matches and stuff. That was unfair. But no, it really did happen. It happened on Sunday. On this morning, ABC's This Morning or This Week with George Snuffleupagus and that guy who frequently wears bow ties and waxes rhapsodic about a brand of baseball that stopped being played about 70 years ago. They booked Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, opposite Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman. Like you, my first thought was, well, that ain't a fair fight. That's like shooting libertarians in a barrel. Which is what Paul Krugman kinda, did. It's not just that Rand Paul was wrong, or that Rand Paul is a moron, which he is. Aqua Buddha and all that shit. Rand Paul, in his ignorance, didn't realize how ignorant he was. And that rises to the level of, like, ancient Greek theater. The one where there's some part in the play where where the protagonist or the anti-hero or whatever the hell it is the analysts are calling it these days, it looks up and goes, huh? What? And Rand Paul had one of those moments on Sunday. Jesus, it was good. This is another one of those moments where the onion edges ever closer to reality.